This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this Sunday morning. And our Sunday morning show features conversations from the past week. This morning, we'll revisit an interview with University of Mary professor and filmmaker Dan Belinsky about his latest project, which is based on the true story of the last lynching in North Dakota. You'll also hear Karen Ahrens, coordinator for Hunger Free North Dakota, talk about the potential for pandemic relief and stimulus funds to raise many families out of poverty. And we'll share a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern. First, a news update from Dave Thompson.
After the initial rush to get the vaccine out, the North Dakota Health Department says they're starting to see a slowdown now in demand for COVID-19 shots. State Immunization Director Molly Howell says it might be a combination of hesitancy and some people being more passive in rolling up their sleeves.
We're really working to make sure vaccination is available at convenient locations, at people's workplaces. We're piloting clinics at large department stores, and we're going to university campuses to offer vaccination. And so we're trying to make vaccine more convenient for people. And we're finding that if they don't have to set up an appointment and vaccine is right there and available, people are accepting the vaccine.
Howell says the department will soon launch a boots on the ground campaign to get more people on the vaccine bandwagon. She says the state has secured funding to promote the effort.
We're planning to use those funding with many contractors, and so local public health, different associations, possibly universities, other organizations, to really work with the people that they serve in educating about COVID-19 vaccine and the severity of disease, because I think there's a lack of understanding about how severe COVID-19 really is.
Over 45% of North Dakotans have received at least one dose of vaccine. February oil production dropped beyond what state officials had predicted. Daily oil production dropped to just over 1 million barrels a day. State Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helms says he anticipated a 2-3% drop, but he says the February drop was 6%. And he says you can trace that to the week of February 14th, a period of extreme cold, especially in the southern U.S.
The Southwest Power Pool had power problems that rolled all the way up into WAPA, and WAPA had a series of rolling blackouts for 2 days, and those impacted Williams, McKenzie, and Divide County.
Helms says natural gas plants had periodic shutdowns, and gas gathering infrastructure was down 20% for a few weeks. Some oil wells also stopped pumping. Helms says operators received very little warning.
They just got calls from Montrell Williams and from McKenzie Electric saying that they were ordered to do load shedding, and that if they couldn't do load shedding, they were going to have to force rolling blackouts.
But Helms says there was better news on oil prices. He says the February price was 4% above forecast, and that's making up for lost barrels. As construction continues on the massive $100 million Amazon Fulfillment Center in North Fargo, another part of the Amazon network is setting up in West Fargo. It's an Amazon hub referred to as a last-mile delivery station. Packages arrive at stations like this from fulfillment centers. They're loaded onto vehicles for speedy deliveries to area customers. West Fargo Mayor Bernie Dardis said it's a great addition to his fast-growing city, adding more than 100 jobs.
When the first rumblings, if you will, or the first thoughts that Amazon was coming into north of the airport there, we did a little research, and it was soon thereafter when they finally did name it that we were aware that they would be looking for space for the hub and that we were under consideration.
USDA is expected to announce updates to a program that could result in more farmland being set aside for conservation. With more, here's Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin.
The Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, is designed to incentivize farmers to protect environmentally sensitive farmland. Right now, the program has a payment limit that some say is far too low. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack says he agrees, and that an announcement is expected in the coming weeks to potentially increase that limit.
We're about 4 million acres below where we are authorized to participate and to provide opportunities in CRP. It's something that I think we're going to be addressing in the very near future.
Vilsack says President Biden is committed to dedicating 30% of public lands in the United States to conservation programs, and that updating the CRP could help achieve that goal. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
The 2021 legislative session is getting closer to the end. One way you can tell is when you hear an announcement like this from the floor from one of the majority leaders.
Next Saturday, don't make any plans, Mr. President, just in case we have to come in.
Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner says the goal is still to be finished next Friday. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Dan Belinsky is the director of theater at the University of Mary in Bismarck. He's also a filmmaker, and his current project, titled End of the Rope, tells the story of accused mass murderer Charles Bannon, who met his end at the hands of a lynch mob 90 years ago this year in Schaefer, North Dakota.
So the screenplay is based on a history that was written by Dennis Johnson, who is a lawyer up in Watford City and a historian up there. And it's an account of the true story of the last lynching in North Dakota. The man was Charles Bannon. He was a 21-year-old farmhand who killed an entire family on their farm in 1931 in Schaefer, North Dakota, which is just outside of Watford City. And he lived on their farm for almost a year afterwards until the town became suspicious. Then they brought him in for questioning. And after some running around, they got him to confess. And they stormed the jail cell later and knocked down the door with a telephone pole, dragged him out of the cell, and threw him off a bridge with a rope around his neck. Afterwards, there was a big statewide investigation to try to find who was involved in this mob killing, but nobody squealed. Nobody ratted on their neighbor because either the whole town was involved or their brother or their uncle or their sister was. And so to this day, no one's been brought to trial for their participation in the killing of Charles Bannon.
What are the plans for filming? What's your schedule? I know you're auditioning, too.
Yeah, so we just had local auditions in Watford City and in Bismarck. We had tremendous turnout. We saw over 500 people just here in North Dakota auditioning. And so we're also accepting auditions from larger markets, professional markets for the lead roles. And we're in the middle of casting now, but hopefully we'll wrap it up by the end of the month. We're planning to shoot in August, and so we're in pretty serious pre-production now.
And you're working with a Twin Cities filmmaker by the name of Charlie Griak. Who's doing what?
So Charlie is directing, and he's co-writing it with me. I'm the lead producer on the project. Charlie has, he's made several feature films, including one that I was an actor in several years ago. And he and I shot another feature film called Lamentations last summer, which will be in theaters this coming fall. That's also a historical North Dakota film. But he's a great guy, a very talented artist, talented writer, director, and editor. And so we're very fortunate to be able to work with him.
Now, are you both working as sort of casting directors, or is that your job, or how is this being done?
So we've hired a casting director out of New York for some of the more significant roles. We've cast some of the other leading roles out of Minneapolis, and I've been working with talent agencies there. And then in North Dakota, I've essentially been acting as the casting director here. And we've had, like I said, we've had a tremendous outpouring of interested people.
Well, you've got at least a mob in this movie. How many people are you going to need? You're recreating a little town, too.
Yeah, we're recreating Schaefer, North Dakota from 1931. So, yeah, we do need the townspeople. We'll probably end up working with a cast of around, depending on the day, 50, 60.
Wow.
So how many days do you expect to be shooting?
We'll be filming a month, 4 weeks.
So this is a full-length feature film, which would be 90 minutes plus or something like that?
Yeah, between 90 minutes and 2 hours.
What significant roles are you still looking for?
We're still casting our lead, the sheriff, C.A. Jacobson, and then a number of the minor parts. I'm just beginning to reach out to folks to make offers. So it's a little bit TBD right now.
Okay. To be determined. Dan Belinsky is the director of theater at the University of Mary. And you've done a number of these kinds of creative projects beyond, shall we say, the stage, because you've got some film and TV background. Do students participate in these projects as well?
Yes, they do. They have a chance to participate on camera and behind camera for these productions. We are starting a new program at the University of Mary. Actually, the theater minor is growing to a dramatic arts major, and students will get credit for participating in the film. So we'll have students both on the crew and in the cast for this production, and it's a tremendous experience for them to be, for my acting students to get the chance to, you know, act in front of the camera and work with professionals and be mentored by these wonderful industry folks that we're bringing in.
Now, you're recreating a period, the 1930s, the early 30s. You're building that small town set to be Schaefer, which is, and Schaefer isn't much of anything these days. You've got costumes, you've got cars, you've got, you know, all kinds of stuff. Who's in charge of all of that?
So we hired a wonderful production designer out of Minnesota. His name is John Paul, and he worked on the movies Fargo and Grumpier Old Men and Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger. So he's a wonderful, wonderful artist. And then we're also working with Brad Reisig, who's the set designer and the technical director at the UND in Grand Forks. For the theater program, I mean, the set designer for the theater program there. And he's also a wonderful addition to the team as art director.
The online database, the IMDb, has a blurb here that describes the film project as, when a sociopathic hired hand murders an entire family, the town of Schaefer, North Dakota, rises up to take justice into their own hands based on the true story of the infamous Charles Bannon case of 1931. Telling the story of a lynching requires, you know, setting the scene and sort of taking the temperature, if you will, of the people who were around this incident when it happened. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's a delicate matter, obviously, and I think the first thing that I always try to clear up is that it's not race related at all. This was white people hanging a white guy.
Yes.
I think, you know, it starts with the people who are closest to the story, which is a special aspect of just this process of turning this into a film, because there, you know, if you go to McKenzie County, anybody who's a real native of that county knows the story of the Charles Bannon case, and most of them have some kind of personal connection to it. So they're grandfather was involved in some way. And I've spent a lot of time in McKenzie County just over the past year and gotten to know a lot of the folks up there. And they're just thrilled that this is being turned into a story, into a movie. And they've all got their own contributions. So they'll pull me aside and they'll tell me, this is what my mother told me. I've never told anybody this before, but I wanted to tell you so you could, you know, possibly use it in the movie. And so it's an honor and it's a responsibility to tell a true story and to do justice to the people that were involved and their descendants who are alive today, who have a personal stake in the story and who are supporting us in many ways to make this film.
That's one of the interesting mysteries about a story like this, Dan, because you say so many people must have known, Governor George Schaefer at the time, according to the North Dakota Supreme Court website, launched an investigation, called it an outrage. There was a national church organization that looked into it as well. How could they not know who might have been involved?
I think everybody in town did know. It's just, I think it points towards a really interesting aspect of the story in that this was a very isolated community. So the northwest corner of the state there was known at that point as the Island Empire. It was cut off on three sides by water. There was no bridge going over the river there. And this was a very isolated community, you know, one generation away from the homesteading era. People were very much used to taking care of themselves. And if there was a problem, they dealt with it in their community. Bismarck might have been, might as well have been Chicago. It was that far away. And so when problems come and, you know, when this man, Charles Bannon, kills a family, the people have a really legitimate concern for their community, and worried about, you know, Charles Bannon not getting justice if they pack him off to Bismarck and him coming back and, you know, hurting their families. I think the fact that he lived almost a year on his victim's farm without people bringing him to task or suspecting that there's foul play really spooked them. And it speaks to the limited communication of the time, because Charles Bannon said, oh, well, the family moved to Oregon. And so they would send messages to Oregon, telegrams, you know, and then the people in Oregon would, you know, it would take them a couple months and be like, no, we haven't seen them here. And then they would send a telegram back to Williston or wherever there was a telegraph office and be like, okay, well, they don't see him here. What do you think? And then there would be back and forth, you know, telegram messages that would just eat up months and months. And meanwhile, he's just living on the farm. And so I think that was a scary thing for people. They were scared for themselves and their families. And I think it's good to think of these people who were involved in the mob killing. Yes, there might have been some who just were violent people, or maybe they were drunk on that night, but these were also just good people making really difficult moral decisions to protect their family. And that's a really just interesting aspect of this story to me, and one of the elements that we're certainly going to explore with the film. This kind of, you know, what is it? Justice can be murky sometimes.
His father, James Bannon, was working on that farm with him. James Bannon, interestingly enough, heads off to Oregon himself to go look for the Haven family members. At least that's the understanding in the North Dakota Supreme Court telling of the story. And yet he ends up in the penitentiary. His son is lynched and he ends up with a life sentence.
Yeah, he was accused of being complicit. And he wrote a few letters to Charles Bannon that seemed to imply that he knew what was going on as well and was just kind of protecting him. I believe he was present in the actual jail when they took Charles out. They knocked the door in with a telephone pole, both the door of Schaefer Jail and then the cell door as well, and they dragged him out, and his father watched that.
And I believe, at least according to one account, that Charles implored people not to hurt his father.
Yeah, I think that's one of those things where it's like in some of the accounts and in other accounts it's left out. It's it's one of those things that may or may not be true. And
well, nevertheless, Charles Bannon did confess. I think he confessed more than once. So why wasn't that sufficient?
So the first time he said it was somebody else. The second time he half confessed, and then the third time he made a full confession. So it worked in stages.
And then in sort of a classic lynching story here, the sheriff and the deputy sheriff and other people are sort of overwhelmed by the lynch mob and are themselves put behind bars. And again, the question arises, how could they not know who was doing this, even if they were wearing hoods and all of that stuff?
That's a good question. I think we'll offer some suggestions, certainly in the movie, that I don't want to spoil, but I think realistically, we can also think that, you know, the sheriff and the deputy of the time, they had to think about their families too, and just what their, like, even if they were commissioned to, you know, defend Charles Bannon, what were their personal feelings about Charles Bannon? We don't really know what happened in that jail cell. We only hear, you know, lots of different accounts, but there's nothing that that everyone agrees on.
You said that the screenplay is based on a history that was written by Dennis Johnson of Watford City. Is that the definitive history, or is there perhaps, maybe this movie will spur one more stab at it while people can still remember what their mom or dad or grandparents said?
Yeah, well, I don't think anybody knows more about it than Dennis Johnson. He's been such a valuable resource for us as filmmakers, and it all started with, you know, me sitting at his at a table in his law office and talking about the story. So he is constantly revising the book. I think it's on its third edition, and you can buy it, I think, online or at the Pioneer Museum in Watford City. And he's always talking to new people. Even through this, like once this film was announced, some relatives of the Haven family, which was the family that was killed, and some relatives of the Bannons actually reached out to me, and I passed their info on to Dennis. And so I think he'll have plenty of new material for a fourth edition.
Okay. How is a project like this funded?
It's supported completely by folks here in North Dakota. There's just been, you know, in the same way we had just a tremendous outpouring of people interested in auditioning for the film, there's just been so many people who have been generous with us, supporting it financially. All people here in North Dakota, many of whom have a personal tie to the story. Most of these people are from McKenzie County, and they know Dennis, they know this story, and I've had lots of meetings with the folks up there, and yeah, they've just been, it's been really humbling and moving for me, the way that people are willing to support us in big ways.
How do you get about distribution? I assume that a theater in Bismarck or Watford City, or for that matter, Fargo or anywhere in the state would welcome this film because it would bring people into the theater. But what about broader distribution?
Yeah, so we'll start with theatrical distribution across the state and even across the region in South Dakota, Montana, and Minnesota. And then we'll go after online distribution and film festivals as well. Charlie, our director, has had several films on different online platforms, and we'll have the film available for not only North Dakota but for the world.
Will you be playing any roles in the, or a role in the movie?
No, I'm just producer. That's enough for me.
Okay. Is this movie being shot on film or is it video? How are you doing that?
We'll be shooting on digital. We have a DP cinematographer that is coming from New York, and he's wonderful. He shoots on a absolutely top of the line camera, and it'll look beautiful. I think between the beautiful landscapes that we have, the amazing sets that we'll build, the great camera we have, the great cast that we'll have, we'll have a good looking film.
Okay. And are you telling the story sort of as a linear narrative? Are you getting sort of the before the family's there and maybe Charles Bannon's there, then something happens, then he gets arrested, then there's this aftermath? Is that the arc of the story, or does it just pick up a piece of that?
So the story is told from the perspective of the sheriff of the time, C.A. Jacobson. He's kind of our protagonist. And it's told through his lens as he struggles with what his moral responsibility is to do. Because on the one hand, he's friends with the Haven family that was killed, and he has some righteous anger against Charles Bannon, but he also has his responsibilities as a sheriff. On the other hand, he's tasked with taking care of the town of Schaefer and McKenzie County, and he wants to preserve and protect these people who also have a lot of righteous anger, his friends in the town who have a lot of righteous anger against Charles Bannon for killing Albert Haven and the Haven family. And so he's kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, trying to decide what the right thing to do is here, whether to protect Charles Bannon or let the mob have its way, or to reveal the names of the mob members, or to keep it secret. He gives us a chance to really explore these difficult moral questions about, you know, what one should do in such a situation.
Well, one of the interesting sidelights to this story is that lynchings were used as an argument for capital punishment, because if you've got capital punishment, you won't have people running around looking for a rope if they get that angry. Do you explore that at all?
Well, that was certainly something that was brought up at the time, that there was no death penalty in North Dakota, and people just felt like Charles Bannon deserved to die. You think about a lot of these people, too, coming with old school traditions. Like I said, one generation from the Homesteading Act, from the homesteading era. So there were people there, you know, Germans from Russia, and there were Norwegians there who had, you know, built a sod house or, just homesteaded and built a farm and subsisted by themselves and just as really close-knit communities for the length of time that they'd been in North Dakota, for the past 20, 25 years. Now somebody is thrust into them who commits this terrible deed. And a lot of them just have old school values too, like kind of an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth kind of thing. But then there was also genuine concern of, like, you know, will this guy, once we ship him off to Bismarck, the quote unquote big city, will he get off? Will the lawyers, because it was all kind of murky, and he had multiple confessions, and I think they had a somewhat justified concern about him not getting the punishment that he deserved, whether it was life in prison or whatever. And the last thing they wanted was him back on the streets and coming after their families, you know.
The movie is End of the Rope. It will be shooting in the Watford City area later this summer in August and released in 2022. Dan Belinsky is the producer. He's working with director and writer, co-writer Charlie Griak. And he's also, of course, a University of Mary theater professor. Dan, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hey, it's Rachel Martin. There are certain things you can always count on. The sun rises and sets. The clocks change come springtime. The weekend never feels quite long enough. Like clockwork, you can rely on Morning Edition from NPR News to bring you trustworthy journalism and keep you connected with your community. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Karen Ahrens has been on our show before. She's a registered dietitian and consultant and the coordinator for Hunger Free North Dakota. Last week, she joined us to talk about the potential for the Biden administration's $1.9 trillion in pandemic relief to boost millions of families out of poverty.
I am honored to serve as a coordinator for a network of organizations that all share the same goal of a hunger-free state. And so we've got groups brought together, from groups that work on growing food to state agencies that help people get food to charitable organizations to rural organizations.
Well, how would you characterize the state of hunger in our state?
I believe from the data that we have available that things have intensified and have gotten worse in the past year, that all of us have been dealing with COVID-19's impact on us. So over the past year, COVID-19 has impacted all of us in many ways. And in particular, when it comes to food access, if you recall back, there have been supply chain interruptions and shifts, some volatility in the food supply. All of us who've been working have seen some kind of interruption in. Some of us have lost jobs, decreased wages, decreased hours. There have been changes in routines at work and school, and we're kind of facing an unknown length of time until more usual social interactions will be able to resume. But the good news is that so many groups across the state have jumped in and assisted in from everything from the Great Plains Food Bank to their partner food pantries and soup kitchens to state agencies who administer the federal food programs and the regional and county social service agencies that administer those programs to schools, childcare, all of those kind of groups, volunteers, businesses have all stepped up to help make sure that this these impacts are not as bad as they could have been.
How do we define food insecurity?
Well, food insecurity is a lack of access every day to enough food to be healthy, enough food every day for a healthy and active lifestyle. So over the course of the last year, we have seen interruptions in that, whether it's for some of us, the first time that we went to a grocery store and weren't able to find the kind of food or a particular brand of food that we'd hoped to find. So that has impacted our food access. But food, and then many of us are dealing with not knowing from day to day or week to week whether we'll have enough money and resources to put food on the table to feed our families.
I've seen a number that nationally, maybe one in five families is food insecure. Do we really know the extent of food insecurity in our state? And is this information difficult to track?
It is difficult to track, but there has been a new tool launched by the U.S. Census Bureau called the Census Household Pulse Survey. And it's an online survey that has been conducted about every couple of weeks or so, implemented in quite quick fashion, that's been tracking indicators over the course of the pandemic. And I have looked at that periodically to get a pulse on where we are in the state. And it seems like things were most impacting families in North Dakota around April and May, and that things are stabilized somewhat now, but we still have, I believe, more people than prior to the pandemic who are not sure that they have enough resources to access the food that they need.
The pandemic has spurred a lot of money spilling out of Washington into the various states, including, of course, North Dakota. If you put together the two COVID relief packages, the one last year and the one new this year, it's about $2.5 billion coming into the state. And of particular interest is the $1.9 trillion national relief package that was approved by Congress in the Biden administration, because that one includes a child tax credit that could literally lift families out of poverty. Could you elaborate on that from the perspective of hunger-free North Dakota?
This is really an exciting prospect that we have before us, that these plans that are starting to be implemented now can lift children out of poverty, because we know that children in families that don't have enough resources, don't have as good of health, may struggle with education and lots of other things that impact their lives all the way down the road. And that we have this opportunity now to make children's lives better is better for an individual child, their families, and for our whole future. So in North Dakota, based on where we were prior to the pandemic, there were about 180,000
children below the age of 18. And it was estimated that about 10% of those kids, or around 18,000 kids, were living in households that were below the poverty line. So according to estimates, the child tax credit alone, the changes in that will make that available to more families, will increase the size of the credit and extend that benefit to 17-year-olds. So one group called Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is estimating that directly because of just this one portion of the American Rescue Act plan, 4,000 children will be lifted above the poverty line, and another 10,000 of our North Dakota children will be lifted above or closer to the poverty line, and that nearly all of the children in the state will benefit from the provisions in this plan.
And the plan would give basically a $300 per month tax credit to families of kids under six, per child under six, and $250 for kids who are over the age of six. But it's a one-year plan. this could be a blip, or it could be perhaps permanent. What's your perspective on the odds of that?
Well, I'm not sure. I hope that once people understand that sometimes the people with the lowest incomes weren't able to benefit from this, and why was that happening? And why would we want to go back to conditions like that before the pandemic? Hopefully, the decision makers, policy makers will latch on to this being a good thing for families and children.
One of the complications is that people in poverty sometimes don't file taxes. And if you don't file taxes, you don't get a tax credit. How are you getting the word out that this is available?
That's not something that we directly do, but I know that efforts are working with trying to reach people where they're at and try to reach people in ways that they can see to make sure that they know how, like going to the library, for example, to access online services that our great libraries in North Dakota can provide to people. And those are just some of the ways that people are trying to be reached.
Karen Ahrens is a registered dietitian and the coordinator of Hunger Free North Dakota, which has been around about 12 years now. And we're talking about the child tax credit, the possibility of that lifting families out of poverty and making them less food insecure, which is specific to her mission. There are ideological differences, Karen, that you're well aware of about poverty and welfare. You once ran for the North Dakota House, and you live in Bismarck, so you're acquainted with the legislative process. Why is there that kind of difference over how best to help people who need help?
Well, that's a great question, Doug. I guess as some people have been looking back on our recent history or even further back, that there are those who believe, starting maybe with the Reagan era, that government is something that should get out of the way. But there are others of those in our nation's past, when in the period of 1965, that there were many programs started that assist people. And that sometimes when people believe that resources directed toward corporations or businesses will trickle down and help people, I think there's a history of that not happening. But I think it's time to give this a try. And with my belief in participating with government programs, being employed by government programs, I worked for the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction with the school lunch and breakfast programs for nearly 5 years. I saw the great benefits that brought to children in schools. I have followed and study and advocate for federal food and nutrition programs, and I believe that they help. And I think at this time, more than ever, when people's incomes and lives have been turned upside down in some cases, that this is an opportunity to for all of us to give a little to help many of us who need it most.
One of the issues here is the word welfare. You mentioned President Reagan. He, I think, coined the idea of the welfare queen, which reverberates today. What if we call it a child allowance as opposed to, you know, lumping it under welfare? What if it's a benefit that goes to people who are helping us, you know, maintain our population and, you know, train people for the future to govern our country and be our technological and educational leaders, that kind of thing? Other countries do that. Is terminology at all instructive here, or am I just blowing smoke?
Well, I think the way that we talk about people with less resources and people with more resources is really important. And I believe that most everyone in our state can agree that children are our future, that when we do things to benefit children, that it benefits all of us. I think that's a place to start, that if you speak of directing our tax dollars that we contribute through our federal tax dollars or maybe our state dollars, the decision makers direct those in a way that help, that it's called a benefit. I think that can be helpful, like you say, Doug. But if we think of people first, I think that always helps to frame our conversations. So if we are talking about a population or we're calling a group as those people or that people who are not like us, but consider everyone within our group or neighborhood, is one way that I've tried to help people think about the way that we talk about and with dignity, respect each person.
As I was preparing for this discussion, I came across something that I'd heard about but hadn't really bored into, and that is Utah Republican U.S. Senator Mitt Romney has proposed a Family Security Act that would increase support for people in poverty above this new child tax credit and would actually get away from the necessity of filing a tax return to giving that responsibility to the Social Security Administration so that these child allowances or this Family Security Act money would go to people every month who meet the standard, the requirement.
Yes, and I think that there'll be lots of rich conversation as that moves through Congress. And I hope that people will come to the conclusion that if people are working in jobs that don't pay a living wage, and we expect that they can successfully raise children, that we think about that again and come up with some kinds of mechanisms, whether it's that one or other proposals that come before Congress, that we do the best to help children become successful and contributing adults to our society.
The legislature is, of course, in session, and they're dealing with all kinds of issues, including some bottom-line budget ones. What are you watching in particular?
Broadly, there have been proposals, not a lot, that directly impact food programs. There was a proposal to provide funding for school meals or even study school meals, which failed in the legislature. So watching those, watching the infrastructure bills, school funding is important. So kind of keeping tabs on all those things that impact people's bottom line and hopefully making sure that we can continue as a society to be able to vote and participate in the democratic process as fully as possible.
Well, we started talking about the pandemic, and of course, I would be remiss if I didn't remind people that you were probably in some newspapers this morning with an opinion piece saying a ban on mask mandates is dangerous. So, Karen, explain to us your position on mask mandates.
I am a member of the North Dakota Public Health Association Governing Board. I've worked in public health for many years, and I believe that masks, face coverings during a time when we're living with a virus that spreads by respiratory droplets is effective at helping to prevent the spread of the disease. Officials with broad and consistent guidelines can help reduce the spread of disease, keep people from being sick, keep people from dying. I think that that's a good thing, and I would hope that the bill that passed that would try to limit those powers would now be vetoed. Every time we talk and think about the pandemic, I like to acknowledge and remember that more than 1,400 North Dakotans and over 500,000 in the United States lives have been lost to COVID-19. And so I'd like to also respectfully remember and know that we'll be dealing with those impacts for a long time, as well as making sure that public health is prepared for the future, for future contagions or pandemics that may spring up, that public health is prepared and is able to respond to help us all fend off disease and protect health.
Masks have been one of those polarizing issues with the pandemic and with ideology and with government. We're talking about specifically here, you were referring to in your opinion piece, House Bill 1323, which would outlaw statewide mandates for masks, although still allow them in other governmental subdivisions. We'll wait and see what happens with that. But Karen Ahrens, thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much, Doug, and just encourage people to be able to take advantage of the benefits of the American Recovery Act plan that we didn't get to touch on, including health care. So check out again and see if people are struggling to find health insurance, to check out the marketplace at healthcare.gov and other things like child care benefits, food benefits that will be coming to help people make it through this tough time that we're in and look to the future that's better for all of us.
More information about Hunger Free North Dakota at hungerfreend.org.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it to you.
Dallas,
Des Moines,
Topeka,
Montana.
You will own your morning when you tune in tomorrow for Morning Edition from NPR News.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a Main Street regular. A distinguished professor of history at NDSU, he's the author of Pacing Dakota and the writer and voice behind our Plainsfolk essays. Today, his essay is titled Cattle Kings and Trick Horses.
If I use the word pastoralism, it's usually misunderstood. People think I'm talking about clergymen, possibly of the Lutheran variety, when really I'm talking of what we in the United States generally call ranching. In the rest of the English-speaking world, that's pastoralism. And if practiced on the open range, that's extensive pastoralism. And the open range is referred to as wastelands. So, in terms the rest of the world would understand, here on the Great Plains, we have a particularly interesting history of extensive pastoralism. It came about because we also have a particularly interesting history of transportation, by which I mean railroads. Elsewhere, in the history of settlement, people like Daniel Boone beat a pathway to the frontier, built their cabins, and hoped others would follow to raise property values. Eventually, investors built railroads and canals to connect settlements to the rest of the world. Here on the Great Plains, we flipped that process. First came the railroads, built with government funding. Then came the pioneer farmers to settle alongside and ship their produce. In the meantime, after the previous, that is, American Indian, pastoral cultures of the plains collapsed under pressure, we had open-range ranching, which was English-style extensive pastoralism outfitted in Spanish gear and vocabulary. While writing a general history of agriculture on the Great Plains for an academic work, I realized what I've been talking about is all a matter of what our animal science people nowadays like to call animal agriculture. so I had to fit it into the narrative. Which wasn't hard, because we have a wonderful literature of extensive pastoralism, ranching, on the plains. I'll mention just a few of the classic primary works in case you're building a personal library. Begin with Historic Sketches of the Cattle Industry of the West and Southwest by Joseph McCoy, 1874. McCoy was the guy with the bright idea of bringing the cattle trade to the little village of Abilene, Kansas, on the Kansas Pacific Railroad, thus transforming it into a global phenomenon. Move on, then, to Andy Adams' Log of a Cowboy, 1903, which recounts memorably how the cattle industry moved north to fill the plains. If you're not satisfied with that, get yourself a copy of Hunter's Trail Drivers of Texas, 1920, for a collection of narratives thick enough you can use it to block your pickup wheels when you park on a hill. A generation after the closing of the open range, the historians take the field. The original cowboy historian was Edward Everett Dale, a cowboy, deputy sheriff, and country school teacher from western Oklahoma, who got himself a couple of degrees from Harvard and settled in to teach at the University of Oklahoma, Stetson and all. There he wrote The Range Cattle Industry, published in 1930. To the north, we have Ernest Staples Osgood, a Massachusetts boy with a degree from Wisconsin who taught at the University of Minnesota. His book, The Day of the Cattleman, 1929, is the classic explanation of how ranching capitalists organized the open range of the northern plains. I do think Osgood is somewhat captured by his sources, which were mainly the papers of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association. Osgood began the trend of celebrating the so-called cattle kings as the aristocratic heroes of the open range. As best I can tell, however, that term was a bit of a spoof used to make fun of cattlemen with aristocratic pretensions. In the 1880s, there was a touring dramatic production called The Cattle Kings that was a great popular favorite. Its stars were a company of performing horses that were brought on stage. Then they exited the stage, as did the extensive pastoralists of the Western Range, once their time was past.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.